Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, I'll be joined by Brother Richard Hendrick to talk about new beginnings, the contemplation of starting afresh, and the tradition of favouring spring as the real start. I'll also be joined by business leader Tom Keogh of Keogh's Farm to talk about family legacy, the importance of supporting Irish food suppliers, and the personal reason he's signed up for Rory Best's Miles to Mayo Challenge. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I have been good. Long-time listeners to the show will know I love the slower pace of the school holidays. And even if you don't have kids, you must be feeling the joy of the ease in the traffic. There's just a slower pace all around, and it is needed. We certainly needed a break in the routine in our house. And I wanted to share something with you. I have found myself worrying about money of late. Now, I'm still in a very lucky position and ever grateful for it. I never forget it. But I suppose between the house, the car needing to be replaced, and work is always a little slower at the start of a new year. I mean, look, my expenses are covered, which again is lucky. But there just hasn't been anything really extra, which as a full-blown adult can be a worry. And I'm sure there's lots of people who can relate or who are in worse situations than I. But it has been taking up my thoughts lately a little. And the reason I want to talk about it here, apart from the fact that I'm an absolute oversharer every time in this section of the show, but because it made me realise the other night when I was thinking about it all, that number one, things always seem far worse at night, don't they? So I'll be going to bed at night and I might have a little pain in the pit of my stomach and I'm fretting about it. And I will try and calm myself, the few deep breaths, seeing as I've got all that training, I put it into action and then I'll get a good night's sleep. Or there'll be times that, you know, I'll be tossing and turning a little because of it. But no matter what, the next day things always seem better, don't they? When the brightness comes, no matter what it is going on, always seems a little bit better in the morning light. But the other thing is that when there's a challenge, it reminded me how tough moments often force you to dig deep, and that's where the learning is. So again, I'm not destitute and I'm very lucky, but because things are a little tight, it's forcing me to be a bit more creative, coming up with plans of what I'm going to do to get out of this a little, putting into action some that maybe have been on the long finger. Now, I don't wish ill on me or anyone, and I also don't mean to be really annoyingly positive about tough times that people can be going through. But when everything's great, we do tend to cruise along a little, which is a very necessary part of life. Do you ever look up to the sky and you can see the birds and they don't have to flap their wings anymore? They're just like cruising along. I mean, who doesn't want bits of that in life? But then perhaps we're not doing some of the things that we said we were going to do and we're not putting in the work of flapping our wings. So I have been flapping in more ways than one recently, which, look, again, cruising can be great sometimes, but when a challenge comes, it often brings with it change and learning. And look, I'm a glass half full type of person, so perhaps that's just how I'm reframing it, but I think that's important too. So I've decided to do 28 Days of Finding Joy. I've been inspired by Dervla Meskel's book of the same name, Finding Joy. So I started on Wednesday, on the first day of April, and I'll continue throughout the month. So I'm going to document 3 moments of joy a day on my Instagram, just to keep me accountable. Even though I struggle with this modern habit we have of thinking something didn't happen if we didn't put it up on social media, which really can often impede the experience of the whole thing, it's just so it's marked and so it's seen. And I have found that although I might take a pic here and there, I've been doing it unofficially since I met Dervla and heard her speak at the Dublin Book Festival event we were at together. And I've been noticing so many moments of joy that I didn't document. So I think it's a really positive and lovely thing to do. So look, aside from me and my bookkeeping and my financial fretting, I think there's a lot going on in the world right now, and seeking joy doesn't mean we're turning away from that, but rather trying to punctuate it with little glimmers of joy. So I would love you to join me and keep me posted on how you're getting on. You can choose to do it on social media or not. Just look for moments of joy in your day. But if you do, Don't forget to tag Dervla Meskel too. She's Dervla M on Instagram. And do email me on the show and let me know if you're doing it and how you're getting on with it. That email address is aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Brother Richard Hendrick is back. This is right up your street, I think, this idea of finding joy, and Dervla Meskel's beautiful book, which is a lot of poetry and musings too.
Well, the Franciscan motto is Pax et Bonum, peace and joy. So it's the very foundation of what we believe the spiritual life should lead to. They're the two great fruits of it, that it should give you equanimity, stability, peace, and that the fruit of that should be your ability then to find joy wherever you are.
And I think people are having that crisis in their minds of how can I be seeking joy when the world is burning? But it's even more important than ever that we do that, if we're ever to show up as the world needs us to right now.
Yeah, so joy is restorative. We need it in order to actually strengthen ourselves, to give ourselves the gift to be able to wade back into the burning world or the kind of dumpster fire that we're seeing all around us at the moment. But this is cultivated joy, not joy as reaction. And they're two very different things. So we would differentiate between joy as elation, which is when something happy suddenly happens. You know, we get the present or the gift arrives or whatever it might be, the little happy moment that we weren't expecting suddenly turns up. And that's a reaction. It's an emotion. But joy as a chosen way of being is something completely different. This is actually slowing down. It's a contemplative practice. It's the ability to kind of be with the spaces between things, the kind of liminality and transitions that take place between the ordinary everyday tasks that so often can be a bit, you know, a bit of a drudgery to us. And instead, actually choosing to receive the day in front of us in whatever shape that day presents itself as a gift, as the possibility of you know, new life, new beginning in each moment. And when we do that, then we're actually cultivating the ability to find joy in the very, very ordinary, rather than waiting for joy to surprise us.
And I describe myself there as a glass half full person, as Dervla Meskel does also. Mm. And mindset is obviously very important. And when we're looking at world events now, is it positive or helpful to reframe them? So instead of saying the world is burning or, you know, we're all doomed, saying the world is awakening, the world is changing. And to think that perhaps this rock bottom moment, though it may feel, can actually be the start of a new world order. And that's not to be, you know, desensitized to the suffering
sure,
people are going through.
Sure. I think it's about seeing life as invitation. So whatever is being presented to us, you know, most of us, the vast majority of us, don't have a huge amount of control over world circumstances that are out there, you know. The control that we do have is over how we react to those things and then how we choose to live in the midst of a world that's like this. And to some extent, I think because of the kind of 24/7 news cycle, because of all of the media, we're kind of much more aware, but we're much more overwhelmed than we would usually have been in the past. You know, when news finally got to us through a newspaper or a radio broadcast or, you know, gathering as a family around the television for the 9 o'clock news, like their days gone past. We're now constantly in this great flow of information. And so part of the gift, I suppose, of choosing joy, of cultivating these moments, is also giving yourself a refraction period in which to recover and restore yourself so that you can then find the invitation around you. That what are the circumstances around you practically day to day, whether that's family or work or friends or whatever, neighborhood even, what is that inviting you to so that you can actually say no to the kind of negative experience that's out there and begin to sort of rebuild the world wherever you are?
Yeah. And obviously, aside from global events, people have all kinds of challenges going on in their everyday. And it is about finding joy within that. And since you were last here, you are now a podcast presenter.
Yeah, somewhat unexpectedly. Yeah. Out of the blue, an Irish studio, Cutdown Studios, got in touch to say that they were interested. They'd heard me as a guest on a few other podcasts, including your own. And they wanted to know, would I be interested in creating a podcast with them that would lead people into those mindful, contemplative moments? Obviously, emerging from our tradition as a Capuchin Franciscan. So we have created a daily podcast. It runs for about 10 to 12 minutes each day. And it's just called The Daily Meditation with Brother Richard. But again, it's about enabling people to have that space, that breathing space that so often is at a premium in our lives. And sometimes we need a little bit of guidance, a little bit of invitation to be able to move into that. And so this podcast allows people to maybe make this as a practice that perhaps would lead to a deepening path for themselves as well. One of our old meditation teachers used to say that the fundamental task of every human being is to choose whether they're going to wake up in the morning and say, good morning, God, or good God morning. You know, it's that's the most fundamental way of being. Are we going to receive the day as gift, or are we going to walk into the day and just be kind of assaulted by it and by all of the problems and difficulties in the world? And what meditation practice does, no matter what tradition you come from, it gives you the ability to kind of stand back, reflect, and begin to choose how you react to things. And so that's what the Daily Podcast is trying to do.
I really enjoyed it. I think it's so, so lovely. And it can be really difficult for people to sit and be still. And I totally get that. And, you know, we've spoken before about that being a misconception about meditation.
Sure.
You know, we can't be without thoughts. It's like asking blood to stop flowing through your veins.
Absolutely.
But it's about becoming aware of them. But by having you there and it be a guided meditation and an invitation by you, it's a lot less daunting. And outside of that 12 minutes, there have been things that you've said in the meditations that have had me pondering later on that day, later on that week. So well, I would recommend it.
Yeah, that's the hope, that we kind of drop a few pebbles into the pools of consciousness and where those ripples go and what reactions or reverberations happen within yourself as someone listening to it. It can be very interesting. I've had lots of feedback, and thank God the vast majority has been really good and really positive. The only two pieces of I don't know if you'd call them criticism or not, we received is that they're too short and people would like more of it. Now, we're already doing it daily, so I can't really do more than that. But it's interesting, as you say, I think people need something as a gateway into this practice and to hold it for as long as it's useful for yourself, and then maybe to move on to deeper ways of practicing. But it'll always be there.
Well, that's good. That's the only negative you've been getting in a cancel
so
culture. You're doing well, Brother Richard. You're doing well.
So far.
You wanted to talk today about new beginnings. I said to you, I'm really feeling the joy of spring. We got a new puppy, and being outside with him is making me notice spring like never before. And this is traditionally the time of year that would be seen more as the beginning than perhaps January 1st.
Yeah, I think we have this big conception that you know, it's always been New Year's Day, 1st of January, midwinter, all of that kind of stuff. And to be honest, it's the worst possible time to start new beginning or resolutions or anything else. Even physically, biologically, our body just isn't in a place where it wants to do that. You know, we drag ourselves out. I think somebody said years ago that the best business to have in Ireland would be a building that was a gym for the first week in January and a pub for the rest of the year. because at least then people could still say they were going to the gym. But what I suppose we're opening up, or what I'm trying to show to people, is that classically, biologically, contemplatively, even within our own tradition, the beginning time of the year was actually mid-March. It was the 25th of March, in fact, was considered the end of the kind of equinox festival, beginning around about the 20th, 21st. In the religious tradition, that was the great feast of the Annunciation, so the beginning of faith itself as well. But what most people don't understand or don't know is that up until the 1750s, legally, that was New Year's Day. And New Year's Day was the 25th of March. It was the day when you began a new job. It was the day when traditionally the court sat in session for the first time. There was kind of a legal and civic government was oriented around that. And it had a beautiful name, just like we have Christmas, you know, in the winter, in the middle of winter. This was Ladymus, which was the feast of Our Lady, the Annunciation. And so the reason it works that way is simply because as human beings, we're part of the great, you know, great cosmos of creatures that's out there. And we live seasonally, whether we know it or not. We're affected by the seasons out there, whether we know it or not. We all know what it's been like to have, you know, the 50 days of rain since Christmas and how that has affected our mood along the way. But I think what people can really understand is that if they work with nature, with the natural cycles of things, as the contemplative traditions have done from the beginning, there's an added boost to that. There's an added advantage to that because your body is now working with your mind. And it's easier to walk into new beginning at this time of year, particularly when you know, as you look up and look around you, the whole of the earth around you is beginning again in its annual cycle. So I think there's a real joy and a real gift to recognizing that if spring is springing out there, the possibility of it springing within me is all the more possible.
Yeah, and I love that with the Celtic wheel also, that's how they would have said, you know, up until now, it was perhaps dreaming only, still resting, but maybe dreaming about what's ahead. And only now do you begin to shoot your fiery arrows out there and see what you'd like to happen later in the year.
Absolutely. The old wisdom of kind of working with the seasons, working with nature, working with the earth itself, there was a reason for it. I have a friend who's a folklorist, and he always says folklore is the knowledge that has survived because it worked. And I think that's what we hold on to as human beings. We hold on to what works. We might even know why it works, but we hold on to it. We can create all kinds of narratives around why we think it works. But the actual fact is, you know, the proof is in the eating. And as we move through the season, if we find that we give the second half of the year to rest and reflect, and the first half of the year to kind of create and produce, we'll be in a much more balanced experience of what it is, rather than this idea that every single day I must be at the top of my my game and I must be constantly producing. No other biological being tries for that or is able for that. And you'll know this with your puppy. The animals are in the present moment. They're great teachers. They show us exactly how to be and how to receive joy when it comes along and how to move towards our needs when we need those needs met. But human beings, unfortunately, we get in our own way so much. And I think a lot of the skill sets that the ancient traditions, be it the Celtic wheel, be it the contemplative traditions, or even just our simple Irish folklore can offer us, there's a deepening possible through those passages, those ways of being that for most of us, we've kind of forgotten about.
Yeah, and that lovely lesson from nature that even though the trees look bare in winter, still everything is going on and now we're getting all the beautiful blossoms. And so rest is still life. And I think it's really, really important. What are some of the things we should be contemplating then in these new beginnings? What energy or thought should we be bringing in to the new beginning?
I think so far as possible, get outside. You know, go to the trees, go to the plants, go to the flowers that are beginning to appear. Listen for the birds that are out there. You know, take the ear pods out every so often. Take the earphones off, and actually just let yourself through your senses arrive at oneness with the nature out there, with creation out there. So we speak of contemplative nature viewing, and that's just actually being present as much as we can be to everything that's coming in through the senses. The second thing is, you know, there is a tradition to spring cleaning, and people don't maybe like to hear this, but even within the monasteries, within the friaries, we clean in preparation for the Easter celebrations, because it's a reminder to us that even the sheer act of cleaning is an act of compassion and service towards yourself, towards those you live with, and even towards kind of maintaining where you are. But we don't always have to be kind of sitting on a cushion to meditate, to take up the broom or the Hoover or the cloth and actually do that mindfully and as an act of kindness and compassion. We end up clearing the space and we end up having a space that's then more open to the possibility of connection. And the other thing is to look at what we're eating and drinking. The latter half of the year, the winter half can often be a bit like the bears, all of us. We want to put on the winter weight and we do that. But now there's the possibility of actually coming into what's provided for us seasonally, what's present to us in a way that kind of lightens our diet and gets us out there. And that's why most traditions, Christianity included, of course, have a fasting period leading into the early spring. So we've had our Lent, we've moved into that. Hopefully it wasn't just, you know, I'll give up the chocolates again kind of thing. But the idea is that we're kind of purifying the system so that we're then ready for the creative side of things when it arrives.
Yeah, I did speak about Lent because I'd seen a couple of things mentioned on social media and that people almost seem to be piggybacking on to Lent. They may have stepped away from, you know, faith in that organized way, but they seem to be piggybacking onto it going, do you know what, this seems like a good time to step away from my phone usage, step away from perhaps sugar or whatever they had chosen. So I threw it out there to people and I said, how many people are doing this as a health and wellness endeavor? Yeah. But the majority of people came back and they were doing it for reasons of faith.
It's still a very, very strong spiritual practice for people, whatever else their spiritual practice may be. I think the idea that a group of people, you know, a collection together are walking this journey in some way, there's also spiritual support in that, no matter what you're doing, whether you're taking on something extra or giving something up. And it's interesting, you know, again, the period of fasting chosen traditionally, we can speak of the idea of the knowledge being with the people was the 40 days, and that has all kinds of spiritual significances. But we know from a neurobiological point of view that it takes 30 days to change a habit. So 30 days plus 10 was the idea of, well, you changed your habit and now you're actually kind of bedding in as well. So there's lots of reasons to do it. And Lent doesn't just have to be, you know, the 40 days before Easter. As Franciscans, we keep six Lents a year. There's six possibilities in terms of actually keeping 40 days of fasting. And we don't do them all, but we have choices throughout the year as to extend kind of Lenten practices into the rest of the year. So we've constant new beginning.
Yeah. And look, I did a wellness talk recently and it was online and we were talking about finding those moments that work for you. And yeah. There was a lady who said it was her faith and prayer, but she was nearly apologizing for it. And, you know, I think nobody should apologize for what works for them, you know, and there's learnings for all of us. I think we should be far more inclusive in our thoughts.
We would always say, I mean, as Franciscans, the essence of the human life is to look for meaning and truth. And as long as you're on the path looking for meaning and truth, you're on the path. So there's nothing to worry about after that.
Well, as ever, full of insight, I would hugely recommend the podcast just a way to sit and be still. I was at a launch of a supplement brand recently, and one of the biggest feedbacks they've had, it's a sachet in the morning and a sachet in the evening. People were saying that was the only time they were taking for themselves in the whole day. So I think that's lovely to hear, but I think we can go beyond a shake of a sachet, I hope, with at least 12 minutes a day. It's called Daily Meditation with Brother Richard. And Brother Richard, thank you as ever.
Thank you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, Tom Keogh is founder and MD of Keogh's Crisps. He covers the role of general manager for the Keogh family business, which comprises of both potato growing and potato packing enterprises. Tom lives beside the farm in his native North County, Dublin, with his wife, Emer, their son, Peter, daughter, Heather, and their dog, Crystal. Tom has signed up to September's Rory's Miles to Mayo Walk, having taken part in the 26 Mountains to Mayo Challenge last year. It's all in aid of the Cancer Fund for Children, an All-Ireland charity that provides therapeutic and emotional support to children and young people living with cancer, as well as their families. And Tom joins me in studio now. Tom, you're very welcome.
Delighted to be here, Claire. Thank you.
Now, very interesting to have you on, because this kind of thing really fascinates me, the idea of family legacy, of farming, even the connection we have in Ireland to the land and to food. So you kind of encompass all of that.
We do. We do. I don't think I had a choice. I was born into it. Yeah. So our family farm, it's about 200 years old, out in rural North County Dublin, between the villages of Ballybottle and Old Town. So market gardening, that's what we've done. If you could grow it in Ireland in our climate and deliver it into the markets in Dublin city centre early in the morning before everybody went to work, that's what we've done. And we've done it for generations.
So when you were growing up, what are your memories of your childhood? What did that look like?
So much fun. And I suppose growing up in that family farming business environment, you were exposed to work from a very, very young age. You know, I remember picking sprouts with my dad, you know, out in a little wetsuit in the field in the frost. And this, I remember the sprout plant being the same height as me. So a sprout plant is about knee height. So it just shows you what age I was when you were kind of brought into the experience of what it was like to be in that kind of farming family business. So from a very, very early age, myself, my brothers and sister, we were all in that family business and working. And I suppose it's one of the key benefits I've brought with me today to where I've got to today is just that real value of hard work, you know, and where it can get you in life. Everything we've done over the years, sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, even broccoli. I remember broccoli as the new brassica arriving on the scene, this new healthy food that I remember my dad sowing the first little field of broccoli. That was back, I think, in the 1980s. But I suppose the common theme with all those products that we grew was that over the years, what eventually happened was cheap imports came into Ireland. And they made it very, very difficult for any growers in Ireland to actually make money cultivating those products here in Ireland. So eventually, a lot of those brassicas, tomatoes, cucumbers, we moved out of those because it was very, very difficult to make money and compete with the cheap products being imported into Ireland from overseas.
Yeah, and it's really sad. I only saw on Instagram recently one of the organic vegetable box suppliers saying another carrot supplier in Ireland has now closed down, and that we've gone from 240 or over 240 vegetable suppliers in Ireland to now 70 and another one gone. I mean, it is shocking, and it is something that we should be shouting about and talking about.
Well, thank you for saying that, because it's a quiet crisis, and it's happening in the background and nobody is talking about it. And there is basically almost no young people coming into horticulture and potato cultivation in Ireland. Today, if I wanted to get a group of potato growers in Ireland under the age of 30, I probably wouldn't be able to get maybe 10 to 12. It's shocking. The year I was born, there was 3,000 commercial potato growers in this country, about 3,000. I think today we have a pool of about 150. And of that 150, really commercially, it could be half. So it's shocking what's happening to our food production and, believe it or not, our food security in this country. Because if we learned anything over the disruption we've had over the last 5-6 years, is that supply chains are really, really weak when you can't get something locally. And supermarkets, I think, have woken up to this as well. That, you know, you do need to be dealing with the local supplier and you do need to be supporting the local Irish grower.
And cost is obviously the factor, and supermarkets are also businesses trying to do their best. We have the cost of living crisis. Groceries is the one thing that just keeps coming up time and time again that people are shocked. But as a conscious consumer myself, for many years, I've walked into my local supermarket, or I try and go to my local store, my smaller stores, as much as possible. But I am picking up bags of carrots and I'm thinking, why has this been flown in from Egypt? Why can't I pick up an Irish carrot, an Irish potato? And I know I'm not alone in that. So not only do we have to push with the powers that be for, you know, legislation and other ways of protecting our food suppliers, but I think as consumers, we need to ask for these things and we need to put pressure on our supermarkets so that this can become more of a reality.
Yes, yes, I completely agree with you on that. The first step in that is to make sure that we get all the labelling correct and the legislation correct around that. And Borbia have done some fantastic work on that. There's probably more to be done, but getting the labelling legislation correct so that if a consumer buys any type of bag of fresh produce, that they have to see where that product was actually grown. You know, not where it was packed. Doesn't matter if it was packed in some warehouse in Galway. It's where was that product actually grown. And that's really important. That's step one. And then I think the awareness with the Irish consumer to actually buy Irish. And it's, you know, we've looked at a lot of research around this. And like, if you ask a consumer on the street, you know, do you buy Irish? Everybody says yes. But in actual fact, when they go and buy something and pick something off the shelf, it's that decision. Everybody's so busy, you know, it's a quick decision and they're not checking. So it is very, very important to check. And I think that, you know, people like Sophie Morris that are quite popular on social media today, and they're telling the story about the origin of the product and informing consumers about their decisions. I think that's definitely helping. And I also think that programs like Clarkson's Farm, you know, the amount of people come to me and say, oh my God, I see the weather's been really bad. And how do you know? Because I was watching it on Clarkson's Farm. You know, things like that help inform consumers about the challenges that growers face on a year-to-year basis. And that has an impact, obviously, in the cost of the product.
What is the difference, though it may seem obvious, if there's going to be a carrot or a potato flown in from outside the country to one that's grown here?
So if you take a carrot, for example, so this time of year, it's not uncommon to see carrots from New Zealand actually on the shelf in Ireland, which is incredible to think, from literally the other side of the planet, where we're bringing carrots in to this country. And as you mentioned earlier on, there was a carrot producer went into receivership only last month here in Ireland, which is incredible to think. And we're flying carrots in from the other side of the world. So the difference you'll find in that product is obviously freshness. And freshness is key when it comes to a fresh product. And we can see, and I've done it in our own stores, that when you harvest a product from the ground, that is ground zero when it comes to optimum nutrition, vitamins and minerals from that product. And then that actually reduces over time. So having that product fresh and close to source and on the shelf as quick as possible is really, really important.
Yeah. And taste is huge. I mean, my sister lives in America now, and we went to visit her. And a real taste test was we headed off. They have snow, and we headed off in the snow for the day as a family. And we came back to my mum's roast chicken, and all the ingredients were supplied to my mum. Mm. And if you've got your mother making the roast chicken, it doesn't get much better than that. And it just did not taste the same at all, from the chicken to the carrots to the potatoes.
Yeah.
None of it. We are so lucky here in Ireland, because we're not producing on the level of bigger countries like America. And when you start to mass produce something, you compromise on quality, you compromise on freshness, and you compromise on taste. And I'm all about protecting that, not only for our health and well-being, but also the joy of food. I think it's so important to our health and well-being that we're enjoying our food.
Yeah. And to use that example, that it resonates for potatoes, and I'll explain why now, but it's one of the reasons why the potato industry in this country has been protected, is that if you ask an Irish person what type of potato do you like, everyone says flary potatoes. You know, we all love flary potatoes. You know, they break open in the pot, throw the big Kerrygold butter on top of the potato. That's what we love, and we're unique in the world. No other country likes flary potatoes like we do in this country. So why? And that's, you know, this is important to me. I'm a potato grower. Why are we all like this? And it turns out that it's we're like this because the potato naturally in our climate, in our soils, has grown in this way. So we have cooler summers. So the crop matures slower. We have incredible sunlight in this country. And that's something we're not aware of. You know, even now it's bright at 6 a.m. It's starting to get bright at 6 a.m. We're getting the longer evenings. You know, midsummer we have 18, 20 hours of sunlight almost. So it's incredible the sunlight we have, the soils we have, and the climate we have. We all complain about the rain, but here on the East Coast, we get about 700 to 800 millimetres a year. It's perfect for potato production. And what it does, that slower, longer growing season produces a product that is far more mature, has a texture that's very, very dry. And us in this country, over generations and generations, have grown to actually like that. And when retailers might bring an imported potato into Ireland, and I've seen it in years where we've had real shortages here, it has happened, potatoes have come in from overseas and the Irish consumer won't eat them because the texture is completely different. Yeah, and we don't like it.
Yeah, and look, I know we're fighting many fires in today's day and age, but if we as Irish people, as multicultural as we are here now, can't fight for the potato, then I don't know where we are at. Let's return to you then a little bit, Tom. You said jokingly at the start you don't think you had much of a choice, but as you started to get to leaving school time, were you tied to this is what I have to do, or was this what you chose to do?
Definitely a choice. Yeah, I think I was very, very lucky. When we were growing, my parents were very clear that you don't have to do this, you know, and very much encouraged, go do something different, you know. I just loved farming so much. I just love the business aspect so much that, you know, I just really wanted to get involved and get into the business end of things. You know, I just had a grow for it. And I think a lot of people do that are brought up in that family business environment. So yeah, even though we were encouraged to do other things, that was very, very clear. It was definitely something I wanted to do, which was to go back and get back at the family farm.
And you've changed it. So what's your ethos as a leader of the business now?
For me, I suppose stage one was I needed to get closer to the consumer. as a farmer, you're the very, very bottom of a big long supply chain, and that put us at a massive disadvantage. We were getting paid very little for our product, and we were completely disconnected from the needs of the consumer. So that was leading to a big, big problem in Ireland when I came into this business, which was back around the year 2000. And between 2000 and 2010, fresh potato consumption in Ireland declined by 50%. An incredible number. And again, nobody was talking about it. But it happened in the background quietly.
Was that the anti-carb message?
Yeah, that was one of the reasons. So Dr. Atkins and the Atkins diet, the anti-carb. And the other thing was a convenience problem. So we had, between 2000 and 2010, if you think what happened in the economy here in Ireland, we all became really, really busy. Employment went through the roof and then crashed again. But we really did change as a nation. And we didn't have the time to prepare potatoes in the kitchen in the evenings. We also travelled an awful lot more. And our diets became a lot more ethnic. Mm. And we, all of a sudden, the potato and the national plate had competition from pasta and rice and other carbohydrates. So our diets started to change. We also found ourselves up against the big international Uncle Ben's, Dalmio, etc., that were marketing themselves on the TV every evening.
Yeah, and that did seem really fancy. I remember that time. And the microwave came. And I think we can all agree a microwave potato is not a good potato.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. Although I do think I tried to solve that. But
oh yes, with the bags now. But when we were just throwing them in and thinking that would cook them.
Yeah, no.
Your baked spud. No, I hear you. I hear you. But you have. And that has evolved very well, I will say. But back then, you could see why the step away came. So you were left with quite a challenge.
Big challenge. Also, we had an image issue. I remember being in a focus group one day and we were asking people about what they thought about potatoes. And I remember there was this young girl at the back of the room, and she stood up and perfect target audience. And she said, but a potato, that's not something I'd eat. That's something my grandparents used to eat. You know, so it was seen as an old Irish food product, whereas today it's come full circle. It's a superfood. You know, it's full of vitamins and minerals. But back then it was not. So big challenges. We also had massive challenges with our markets. The markets were completely changing, whereas my father would have dealt in the Dublin City Corporation fruit market here, dealing with all the traders, selling his products. All of a sudden that was disappearing and the big groups were forming. So there was no more corner shops. It was a Spar or a Centra or a Mace or a Super Value. Tesco came into Ireland. You had the discounters come into Ireland. So all of a sudden, from being in a position where you could probably sell your product to 200 people, you now could sell your product to 5. And that completely changed the whole commercial scene around fresh produce production here in Ireland. So they were the challenges facing me. And back to my earlier comment about getting closer to the consumer. We knew we needed to get closer to the consumer if we were going to solve the issues with this product. And getting closer to the consumer meant developing a brand. We knew we had a fantastic quality product and it was differentiated. But we needed to be able to get the consumer to recognize that, to add value to our product. We needed to be able to speak to the consumer so we can know what they wanted. And that led to the brand, the Kyo brand as we see it today. It led to things like easy cook potatoes. We were the first people in the world to develop a cook in the bag potato. It led to lots of new variety innovation. And over the course of those maybe 10 to 12 years, slowly but surely, we turned the wheel. We turned the wheel and we took an annual decline of about maybe 13 to 15% in consumption. That started to level off and started to increase. And believe it or not, one of the biggest boosts to potato consumption in this country was COVID. Because the pandemic, all of a sudden everybody was at home. And we rediscovered what it meant to cook a meal in the house. A lot of people did. And potato consumption, from memory, I think increased by about 30% that year.
Look, Tom, I could talk to you about potatoes all day. I mean, I really could, but I will have to take a break. And when we come back, I want to get into the charity challenge that you have ahead and the very personal reason that drove you to sign up.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking
on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking on News Talk, where I'm joined in studio by Tom Keogh of Keogh's Crisps, who is taking part in September's Rory's Miles to Mayo Walk. So tell me a little bit about it, Tom.
This is an incredible charity, Cancer Fund for Children, and it's close to my heart. We went on a journey with my son when he was five, so I'm only delighted to be able to take part in initiatives that with the Cancer Fund for Children. I started last year. We did the 26 mountains, so we climbed the tallest peak in every county in Ireland in 9 days, which was tough. I'm not going to lie. There was about 22 business leaders from around Ireland, led by Roger Johnson, and we raised 1.8 million. Yeah, we did it in 9 days, and that money went to help fund the construction of a Daisy Lodge in Cong in County Mayo, which is the first one in the Republic of Ireland. There's a very successful Daisy Lodge operating in County Down, just outside Newcastle. It's an incredible place. And the care that they can give to families affected by cancer in children is just unreal. You know, we don't actually have anything like it here in the Republic. So Cong is going to be the first one. And that's opening, I think, early next year. Rory Best had been a huge patron of this charity for years, and Rory has already done two incredible walks, and each in one in 2021, one in 2023, raising well over a million euro on each one, and all that was going to help fund these projects with Cancer Fund for Children. So this year we're back. Rory's last walk, it's the trilogy, and we are walking 235 miles around Ireland. So basically, it's a marathon a day for 9 days. We start in Derry. We go from Derry across to Belfast, Belfast down to Dublin, Dublin down to South Kildare, to Carlow, to Cork, up to Galway, and then eventually we finish at the site for the Respite Centre in Cong in County Mayo that's under construction at the moment.
Wow, it's special, but it's a challenge as well. So you're obviously a busy man, you're a family man, you're a businessman. So how important is it for you to give back, and how do you find the time to make sure you're factoring that into your everyday?
It's incredibly important. It's more than important. It's a privilege, you know, to be able to get to the stage I'm at where I have the team behind me to allow me to take time off to do things like this. It's just so rewarding. And it's also hugely enjoyable too. You know, yeah, it's tough. And last year was incredibly tough. But, you know, you come away from something like that and you say, my God, you know, I made a difference there. You know, and that's an incredible feeling to have. So it is a privilege. And to be able to see what you do being put into practice in such a fantastic way with these young kids is just life-changing.
Tell us about your son. How are things now?
My son, Peter, really good, really good. We are very, very lucky. So in, I think it was, what was it? Christmas 2021. Yeah, we were coming, believe it or not, we'd spent 2 years building a house. The night we moved into the house, we'll get my son ready for bed, and I noticed bruising all over his body. And my wife's a nurse. Everyone's just so busy before Christmas, moving into a new house, etc. The next morning we woke up and then it got very bad. And that led to a trip into Temple Street. Literally 2 hours later, I got a phone call and we found ourselves in isolation in Temple Street Hospital with the fear of our son having leukemia. So that was just before Christmas. We spent all Christmas in Temple Street. We obviously, it was quite difficult to get tests done, etc. We didn't know what we were exactly dealing with. We just knew that our son got really, really sick at that time. Eventually, we were transferred to Crumlin, to St. John's, the cancer ward in Crumlin. And the results eventually came back. And believe it or not, it wasn't a leukemia. They didn't know what it was. And that was really scary. We would eventually learn that he had a very, very rare blood disease called severe aplastic anemia. And in severe aplastic anemia, it's treated just like a cancer. But what happens in severe aplastic anemia is that your bone marrow just shuts down. It's a fatal disease and you're basically kept alive with blood transfusions. You've no immune system, so everything is making you sick. Even the bacteria in your own body is affecting you. So it's very, very difficult to manage. So the only cure, the only real cure for severe aplastic anemia is a bone marrow transplant. Very, very similar to how you treat leukemia in a child. We were incredibly lucky in that Peter's little sister, Heather, who was 3 at the time, she came in as a match. And, you know, that was just, you know, life-changing for all of us. So we went through that journey for a bone marrow transplant in St. John's in Crumlin. It was an incredible roller coaster. Really, really difficult time. And thankfully, it was a success. And after, I think we were, got home after about 4 months. Probably changed, you know, we isolated then for a long time after that as well, obviously to help the immune system build up, etc. But today, looking back, it was just, you know, an incredibly difficult experience. But to see the kids, Peter's, his transplant was the 15th of March, just Sunday gone. And we went into Crumlin with the team, you know, to be able to go in and just smile and laugh and talk about, you know, what went on is just, it's just incredible. And, you know, just even to see the kids laugh. Heather now is just turned, she's 7, she will be turning 8, but they're now starting to understand what happened. You know, and they call it their bow and arrow. She's like, yeah, you know, I give you my bow and arrow. You know, so they're starting to have lots of fun around that. But I suppose to go through that experience, I had incredible support around me. My wife is a nurse. We had all the grannies and granddads were able to help out. We had incredible support and we got through it. But to see other families that don't have that support and how they cope. And that's where something like this Cancer Fund for Children, that's where that really does add value, you know.
And it just shows you, like, life can just turn. Mm. You never know what the next day is going to bring. And I really get a sense from you that you don't take anything for granted anymore. I'm sure you didn't. You were very happily moving into a new family home. Mm. And you very much appreciated your family. But our health, you know, is just something that can just change. And, you know, to come out the other side of it, I can see is something that you just really, really value.
Yeah, I think every experience in life, you need to fall forward from. And for me, you have to take the positives from that experience. As tough as it was, every day today is a little bit more special because of what we went through. You know, that's the truth.
So you're giving back, you're doing this incredible event. So how can people support you and find out more?
So the best resource is the website, the cancerfundforchildren.com website. And if people visit that website, all the information about this amazing charity is there. Down the bottom of the page, you'll see a big box about Rory's Miles to Mayo. Click on that. That has all the information about the initiative. There's a donation link is there as well. If people would love to donate to it, God, that'd be fantastic.
And Kyo's?
Very simple, kyosfarm.ie. We're on all the social media channels as well. Just search up Kyo's Farm. I'm sure you'll get us there.
Well, you've done a great job of what you set out to do, because as a consumer, as I spoke about earlier, I do feel an attachment to the brand. I feel like I know it. I live in North County Dublin. I drive by the farm. I love to pick up in my supermarket. So
you'll have to pop into us the next time you're passing.
I'll have to pull up my sleeves and get stuck in and fight for this potato I keep talking
wellies.
About.
Yeah.
Tom, thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Claire.
So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aoife Breen, and to Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound, to Rory Galvin, who was on podcasts. Thank you to all my guests, and especially to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.